Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in African American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jared Bichetti, and I'm thrilled to be joining the New Books in African American Studies series. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Professor Elise Eve Weinbaum, a professor of English at the University of Washington, to discuss her newest book, The Afterlives of Reproductive Slavery, Biocapitalism and Black Feminism's Philosophy of History, published by Duke University Press in 2019. Joining a steady stream of new scholarship investigating the centrality of sexual violence to the institution of chattel slavery in the Western Hemisphere, although going a step further to consider the ideological legacies of racialized reproductive practices in the present, The Afterlives of Reproductive Slavery investigates Atlantic slavery's reflection in and refraction through the cultures and politics of human reproduction that characterize late 21st century capitalism. The book argues that racial slavery lives on through a racial and economic calculus, or slave episteme, and that Black feminists produced in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, which constitutes a specifically Black feminist philosophy of history that reveals reproductive slavery's afterlife. Welcome to the show, Professor Weinbaum, and thank you so much for finding the time to sit down with me to discuss your magnificent new book.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So as you know, every book or piece of scholarship has a history of its own. And before we dive directly into the many nuances of your new book, I thought it best to begin by discussing how you yourself became interested in these research topics and how you came to write The Afterlives of Reproductive Slavery.
So, you know, this book is connected to a longstanding inquiry for me about the relationship between ideas of race and racialization and processes of reproduction, human reproduction. And I have been working on this stuff since I was an undergraduate student. And I think it came out of an interest, a feminist interest in reproductive justice issues and anti-racism. And it sort of began as an interest in contemporary reproductive politics and anti-racist politics, and then slowly became my academic work over time. And so my first book is called Wayward Reproductions, and it's about the idea of race and reproduction as it exists in transatlantic modern thought. And the main idea in that book is this idea that the reproductive body in modernity is understood to be a fount of racial identity and of racial formation, so families and nations. And that this idea of the maternal body or the reproductive body has formed the basis for all kinds of problematic ideologies, including modern nationalism. And I make an argument that race and reproduction are sort of bound together. And so, you know, in that book, I was looking at modern thought systems like Marxism and evolutionary theory, psychoanalysis, and first wave feminism, Black radical traditions, Black radical internationalisms. But I didn't get as heavily into capitalism as I wanted to. And so this book is really a second installment in a very long thought process about race and reproduction. And it's meant to really take up this question of how race and reproduction come together or are bound together in capitalism over its long durée and and in the context also of what, you know, some scholars call racial capitalism. So a kind of capitalism that has racism at its very core.
And you certainly had your work cut out for you with this book. And it, to me, it was truly remarkable to consider all of the interventions that were made in the afterlives of reproductive slavery across so many different interdisciplinary fields, that many of which you just alluded to, among them racial capitalism, the history of slavery and capitalism, Black feminist theory, and, you know, more recently studies of slavery and capitalism. But I was hoping you could briefly discuss the interventions you set out to make with this book when you began writing it, and how your ideas evolved as you researched and wrote the book itself.
I guess I thought I was making a couple different interventions and into different fields, but they're all interconnected. One of them was a sort of account of how we got where we are. So how is it that we live in a world in which the reproductive labor process, women's in vivo reproductive labor, is extracted and sold, and reproductive products are sold on the market alongside other products? What's the history of this current moment, and how can we find its roots in the slave past and in the culture of slave breeding? In the context of Atlantic slavery. So one question was about in vivo reproductive labor and its exploitation over time, and the extraction of commodities from the reproductive body over time. And another question was about how to think the connection between disparate historical moments. So how do we understand the connection between what I would call biocapitalism, our current moment in which life itself is commodified, and that 400 years of chattel slavery in the Americas and the Caribbean? What's the relationship between these two? So that was another animating question. And, you know, at the center of that was what has happened to the reproductive body over time, to the reproductive process. In slavery, the reproductive process is a racializing process that produces commodities. And it dawned on me that in the contemporary moment, it is also a racializing process that produces commodities. So how can we bridge this? And then that took me into this discussion about Black feminism, because as I researched this more and more, I began to feel that my fellow travelers were Black feminist scholars writing in a number of different idioms. So historians, but also legal scholars and social scientists, and then literary scholars and writers, so creative writers, who were all in different ways using a Black feminist lens to think these connections between the slave past and the contemporary moment of writing. And so then it became, over time, also an inquiry into a genealogy of Black feminism and its treatment of the question of human reproduction.
One of the most striking elements, I think, of your book is the way in which you refer to throughout it as the constellation between the slave breeding past and the biocapitalist present, which I'm happy to discuss with you further in a few minutes. But as historians, we're often cautioned to avoid the presentist pitfall, if you will, in our scholarship. Although it's certainly undeniable that our political consciousness and decision to pursue particular areas of historical research are informed by our present moment in the world around us. And so in the introduction of The Afterlives of Reproductive Slavery, I really liked the quote that you borrowed from Walter Benjamin, the phrase of the time and the now, and that your book truly is a meditation on the past as much it is about the present. And so I found the connections that you draw between the commodification of human reproductive labor and reproductive power across four centuries of chattel slavery, and again in the 21st century, to be so incredibly thought-provoking. So as a forewarning, this is kind of a multi-part question, so I'll do my best to go to each of the questions one by one for the sake of clarity. But before we begin, could you define for the listeners what the slave episteme is and the ways in which you deploy it throughout your book?
So the concept of the slave episteme is one that I develop to talk about the thought system that is passed down from chattel slavery into the present moment. So how it travels in and with capitalism over time. And that slave episteme has as at its core the notion that the Black woman's womb as a source of commodities, both in the form of reproductive labor power, but also in the form of chattel and children. And so the idea there is that the idea that the womb itself could be a source of commodities is the slave episteme. And that idea is one that is really invented and elaborated in the crucible of Atlantic slavery. And so the concept of episteme is one that really comes out of Foucault and people that think about a Foucauldian framework for thinking certain questions about history. And it's a concept that he usually uses it to talk about the modern episteme, but it's that sort of whole array of ideas that are bound together in complex ways to create and characterize the thought system of a historical moment. And I'm trying to suggest that that thought system is transferable across time. But of course, the way that we think about things is also always informing the way in which they're materialized. And so the slave episteme is both an epistemic concept or conceptual and philosophical ideological concept, but it is also materialized through the practice of extraction of reproduction.
Sure. And it, to me, I found one of the critiques that you make of Foucauldian analysis in the ways in which it somewhat turns a blind eye to race, and by, you know, building on the scholarship of individuals like Mumembe and Wehaley, you are able to really demonstrate that race and the racialization of reproductive labor itself is at the center of conversations of biopower that individuals like Foucault themselves aren't always attuned to in their own thinking and writing.
Exactly. That's it. You said it. I mean, so another piece of the book, another theoretical intervention the book makes is in solidarity with the work of Black Studies scholars and post-colonial scholars who have sought to centralize the racial dimensions of biopower and to recognize the ways in which those fall out of the Foucauldian theorization of biopower and the ways in which they need to be restored to make the concept relevant for contemporary analysis.
Do you remember the kind of the aha moment that we sometimes have when you came up with the conceptual framework of the slave episteme? And when you came to realize that many of these exploitative reproductive processes rooted in racial slavery had resonance in modern day biocapitalist practices?
I don't know that I can say that there was exactly one moment. It was kind of a gathering over time of thoughts and thought fragments. But I think that the problem that brought me to that solution was the realization that it was a thought system that was transferred over time and not an exact replication of slavery per se. And so what we have in the current moment isn't the continued exploitation of the Black woman's body as the source of commodities and of capital and of surplus value. What we have is the continued animation of the idea that a body can be racialized in order to be exploited for its reproductive potential. And so it's about tracking ideas that have material consequences, as opposed to saying that contemporary biocapitalism and slavery are the same thing, because I'm definitely not saying that. I am not trying to say that there was slavery then and there's a form of disguised slavery now. I'm trying to say that there's a way of thinking about the reproductive body, about racialization, processes of racialization and of reproductive extraction in the context of racial capitalism that endures even as it morphs over time.
I found also that aside from, you know, an excellent interdisciplinary examination of reproductive labor across American history, and also more recent studies of, you know, feminist studies of biocapitalism, that the afterlives of reproductive slavery is truly a work of intellectual history. And so much of your book is And the argumentative thrust of your book is steered by a number of terms and conceptual frameworks. And so for viewers who are less versed in this field or who have not yet read your fantastic book, would you mind defining the concept of biocapitalism as alluded to in the subtitle of your book and how you engage it in your scholarship more broadly?
Mm-hmm. So that concept of biocapitalism really comes out of recent work over the last decade and a half by folks in the social sciences who have been looking at the ways in which capitalism has commodified life itself. They're thinking about the commodification of DNA and the patenting of DNA. They're talking about the rise of big pharma. They're talking about the commodification of stem cells and then eggs and sperm. And for feminists working on the question of biocapitalism, they're talking about the commodification of things that are much more fleshy, like babies, vital organs, the organ trade, and then in vivo reproductive labor, so surrogacy. And so it's a term that can actually encompass all of these things and potentially more as technology allows for the extraction of the body in new ways. And it's essentially a way of talking about capitalism that understands that the bio, prefacing capitalism, the biological, has become a domain of extraction, which it has always been, but really understanding the robustness of that in the contemporary moment. One of the arguments that I make in the book is actually that slavery is a form of biocapitalism, although it's only in retrospect that we can apply that label to it.
For listeners who are often confronted by the notion that slavery was an antecedent to capitalism, you make a very forceful argument against this line of thinking. And I think new scholarship on the history of slavery and capitalism that is coming out in the present day is really attacking this notion that slavery was, you know, a precedent to industrial capitalism as we know it today. And so if you would, could you kind of dissect this argument and the ways in which you critique traditional Marxist frameworks about slavery and specifically the role of biocapitalism in the, you know, larger question of the ways in which capitalism came to be bound up so heavily in the exploitation of women's reproductive labor, specifically enslaved women?
Okay, I think there's probably two parts to that question. One of them, I think, is about Black Marxism as a framework and about a notion that capitalism has always been a racializing economic system that depends on processes of racialization to denigrate laboring bodies and extract value from them. And that's the case, obviously, in slavery with the production of Blackness, but it's the case in other capitalist formations as well. And that corrective to the traditional Marxist analysis, which sort of sees race as simply incidental or one instrument among many that might be used to make capitalism go, what Black Marxists have argued, and I'm talking about people like Cedric Robinson, but others as well, is to really make the claim that races and racism are constitutive to the process of capitalism. And so within that line of argument, you cannot separate off slavery as something that comes as a pre-emergent formation before capitalism proper, but you're really beginning to recast slavery. And Eric Williams, the historian, was one of the first to do this, to really recast slavery as an originary moment of primitive accumulation for racial capitalist processes. And so it's a different historiography, and it's a different temporal account of the stages of capitalism, and it's an insistence on the foundational connection between processes of racialization and capitalist extraction. And so I do think that while you say there's resistance, or I'm not sure that's the word you use. What word did you use? That there's resistance to the notion of slavery as a capitalist institution?
Or in terms of the temporal, the development of industrial capitalism in the American economy and the economic sense of it being a very early 19th century phenomenon. And then the ways in which scholars, including Jennifer Morgan, Sasha Turner, and others who study enslaved women's experiences in the wider Atlantic world, have demonstrated that the exploitation of enslaved women's bodies, both for their productive and for their reproductive labor, were, as you just alluded to so eloquently, precisely these forms of primitive accumulation that individuals like Williams and Cedric Robinson discuss. Although they're not directly speaking to one another, these historiographies often seem, and which is another one of the interventions I think that your book makes, is that the scholarship of Black feminists is not often conceived of or, you know, understood to be a part and parcel, if you will, of the Black radical tradition. And so the ways in which reproductive labor has escaped the purview of scholars of slavery and capitalism, I think, is one of the elements of your book that scholars who are interested in these subjects will find very enlightening about it.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think that's exactly it. You know, it's an intervention, a feminist intervention into how we understand the Black radical tradition, which has typically left out the gendered component of the analysis or the reproductive component of the analysis of racial capitalism, the ways in which slave breeding was at the center of slavery as a system, which is an argument that Sasha Turner and Jennifer Morgan make, as you point out, in which the more masculinist interventions into the theory that comes under the label sometimes of Black Marxism don't make. So there's the feminist intervention, but then there's also just the Black Marxist intervention, which is why it's really a two-part question, which is just that really deep understanding of the racial logic of capitalism over its entire history. And so I'm going with the Black Marxist tradition in that regard, and then I'm critiquing it alongside feminist historians and others who have done the important and really groundbreaking work of understanding the ways in which slave breeding and slave women's reproduction was really at the very center of the what Walter Johnson calls slave racial capitalism.
So returning to the subject of biocapitalism, in chapter one of your book, you mobilize two really important court cases. In order to help your book's readers situate the contested history of surrogacy practices and the ways in which these cases spurred Black feminist scholars and Black feminist legal scholars more specifically to begin considering the relationship between slave breeding in the past and surrogacy in the present. So I was wondering if you could walk our listeners through these two cases and contextualize how Black feminist responses to them informed the notion of reproductive labor as a racialized process in the modern era.
So when surrogacy first really came to public attention in the United States, it was around the Baby M case in the mid-1980s. And the Baby M case was a case in which a surrogate who was inseminated with the sperm of the person that had contracted with her to bear a child had that baby, gestated that baby, and had that baby, and then did not want to give up the baby, which became known as Baby M, to the father who had contracted her to engage as a surrogate. And so she actually absconded with the child and attempted to maintain custody of the child, but the courts eventually took that custody away from her and gave it to the person that she had contracted with and his wife. So that was one really important surrogacy case, a very dramatic surrogacy case, which brought the question of surrogacy as a practice before the American public and kind of made people begin to understand the potentials for exploitation in the surrogate process, the feelings of mothers about having their reproductive labor and products extracted, but also the ways in which the legal system could be used to enforce the smooth workings of capitalism. And in those days, in the 80s, surrogates received roughly $10,000 for becoming gestating and becoming surrogate mothers. And the lion's share of the profit went to the lawyers who basically organized these contracts. So that case was very important. It was a watershed case. There's very few people that write or talk about surrogacy that don't refer back to the rulings in that case. And then the legal scholarship, which emerged out of it, which came from all quarters and was really oftentimes an argument that divided along two lines. Surrogacy was a liberating practice. It should be something that we found a way to do. It allowed women to enter the labor market in new ways. It was a social good. And those who really regarded it as a form of exploitation. But it wasn't until Black feminists took up the case and really started analyzing it, mostly in legal journals, that they made the connection between the practice of surrogacy and the practice of slave breeding during the 400 years of Atlantic slavery. And these legal, this legal scholarship, probably the two most well-known would be the work of Dorothy Roberts and Patricia Williams, but there were actually many, many others, many articles on this that really sought to make this connection and to really understand that when Mary Beth Whitehead refused to turn over her child, she was refusing the reproductive extraction in a manner that was similar to the ways in which slave women who attempted to run away with their children or to free their children from slavery along with themselves were also objecting to the system of reproductive extraction that bound them. So that's one of the cases. Would you like me to discuss the other one or?
Yes, please.
So the second one comes later in 1990, and it's Johnson v. Calvert, and that case is different because by the by 1990 and by the early 90s, the kind of surrogacy that happened in the Baby M case was no longer common practice. So that was the insemination of a surrogate's own egg in her own womb by the sperm of the contracting party. But by the 1990s, almost all surrogate practice had become gestational surrogacy, in which any woman's body could be used to gestate an embryo that had been created through a donated or purchased egg and donated or purchased sperm, reinserted into the womb and gestated. And this meant, of course, for the first time in history, that the race and genetic profile of the body gestating the child didn't need to bear any relationship at all to the child that was going to come out of this womb. So in Johnson v. Calvert, Johnson, who was a Black woman who was also American Indian, identified as both, gestated a child for a white man and his Filipino wife. And during the course of the pregnancy, again, like Mary Beth Whitehead, decided that she did not want to turn over the child to whom she was genetically unrelated to the parents with whom she had contracted. And she too, when the legal proceedings unfolded, was denied custody of that child, who was understood to belong to the contracting parents because they were the owners of the genetic raw materials that comprised that child. And so I think that what's so interesting about the second case is we really understand how the Black and Native woman's body is turned into literally a reproductive resource that can produce, in this case, a white-looking child for an interracial couple that wanted a white-looking child with genetic relation to the father. And so, again, Black feminists came in with a really intensive analysis of this case. This case, it was easier to mark out the racial logic because the woman herself identified as a Black woman. But I don't think it was necessary for her to be in a Black body for the racial logic of slavery to be animating the case and the question of surrogate extraction. And this is one of the big arguments in my book, which is that reproduction itself, when it's turned into commodified labor, is a racializing process that racializes the labor power, the body performing that labor, and in complex ways, the products of that labor.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
For me, one of the connections that was so well made in your discussion of surrogacy and its relationship to slave breeding in the past was the notion of partus sequitur ventrum that was used to govern the logic of chattel slavery in the Americas. However, you are very clear to state that this has been practiced throughout slavery in the longue durée, if you will, versus a distinctly 17th century phenomenon forward. But it's the notion that the product of the women's reproductive labor is alienable from the mother, and that in terms of surrogacy, it's difficult to consider the notion of the product of reproductive of Black, especially enslaved women's reproductive labor itself, that these bodies can be sold and exploited for profit.
Yeah. So partus sequitur ventrum is completely key to this understanding of the connection between the slave past and the biocapitalist present. And it's really the doctrine that racializes the slave woman and her property, and thus produces the Blackness of both of them. And in the process, it renders that slave woman's child, as you say, alienable, but also fungible. To be Black is to be a living commodity, in a sense, in the context of slavery. So I think that this is the idea, PSV or partus sequitur ventrum, is one of the central pieces of the slave episteme that gets passed down through time. And again, the point is not that it's passed down exactly as it existed in the context of Atlantic slavery, but it's passed down in as a logic of racialization of laborer and progeny, of in vivo reproductive labor and the products of that labor, that makes it possible for that product to be both alienable and fungible, and for that reproductive labor, gestation, and it's so much more than gestation, of course, to be both alienable and fungible. And so those pieces still exist in the practice of contemporary slavery, in the practice of contemporary biocapitalism. And I think it's, you know, people will make the argument, well, you know, the surrogate is not a slave. No, the surrogate is not a slave in that sense. Although when we really get into the details of the contemporary practice of surrogacy as it exists around the world, the deprivations that force women into surrogacy and the conditions under which they labor as surrogates often look a lot like slavery. But it's not to say that the surrogate is a slave, but it is to say that there's something about that process of gestating a child for pay, of turning the womb into part of an extractive reproductive economy that allows that child, until it's adopted into the family and in a sense humanized, to exist as a commodity that's transferable. And, you know, there is a lot of denial that goes in, on in debates, contemporary debates among scholars of surrogacy about how to understand the commodification of the children that are produced by surrogates. Is it the reproductive labor that's commodified, or is it the child that's commodified? And I think that's a kind of wrongheaded question, because I think it's the whole process is saturated by the logic of commodification. And until that child is transferred and moved into the context of a family, it is existing as something that that has been produced to create surplus value.
So I found chapter two to be also incredibly rich, and I would highly recommend it to our listeners who seek a better understanding of enslaved women and their experiences with sexual violence in their day-to-day lives. But in it, you develop your framework of Black feminism's philosophy of history and argue that Black feminist writing in the 1980s and 1990s, but also some in the late 1970s as well, gendered the Du Boisian notion of the general strike against slavery to encompass bond women's insurgency against forced breeding and other forms of sexual assault. And so, pausing for a moment, because there are truly so many questions I'd like to ask you about this chapter in particular, I thought it may be productive for you to discuss how late 20th century Black feminists inserted themselves at the center of the Black radical tradition, which historically has been understood in a highly masculinized manner, which we spoke about very briefly earlier in thinking about the scholarship of individuals like Cedric Robinson and Eric Williams in the context of Black Marxism. But for me, I'm thinking about the ways in which Black feminist writing in this moment were not only engaged with the enslaved past, but were thinking about larger questions of reproductive freedom in the present, and the ways in which the issues over surrogacy and other emergent biocapitalist practices truly informed the writings that they were producing during this time.
Yeah. And it's no coincidence that the sort of heyday of Black feminist publication across those three decades is really the mid 80s through the early 90s, which is also the period of the emergence of surrogacy and of the bioeconomy as something that was visible and understood and began to be analyzed by scholars. And so though feminists, Black feminists, are not often understood to be theorists of biocapitalism, in some sense, I'm making an argument that they were written by their times, and that the theory, the legal scholarship, and the creative writing, the fiction that they were producing, was responsive to this moment of the emergence or of biocapitalism, and therefore the transfiguration of the face of capitalism in their time. And that as they reached back to slavery, they were doing so in a way that animated that historical inquiry in and for their present moment. And so while sometimes that is explicitly a connection that's made, as it is in the scholarship, the Black feminist legal scholarship on surrogacy that we just discussed, and which I discuss in the first chapter of the book, for many of these feminists, the connection is less explicit. And yet there is a way in which I'm making an argument that there's a philosophy of history that emerges from this work, because it is about connecting the moment of textual production or of activist or theoretical production to the insurgency of slave women. And so I'm writing about a whole different range of Black feminist scholars. So it starts with the work on Black feminist legal scholars, but then it goes to the work of Black feminist historians who are exploring and centering the experience of sex and reproduction and slavery. And then it moves from there to what really, in retrospect, we've come to call the neo-slave narrative, which are all of those novels that were written that attempted to imagine the world of enslaved women by centering their experiences of sex and reproduction in slavery. And so the most famous of those is, of course, Toni Morrison's Beloved, but there are many others. And then there are texts that, although they're not often understood as neo-slave narratives, I would argue are actually part of that form of cultural expression. So I'm thinking too of the speculative fiction of Octavia Butler. But if you want to run out the list of Black women writers who were thinking about slavery, you have Shirley Ann Williams and Cooper and and Gail Jones, and the list goes on and on. And so there are so many people that in this moment of the 80s and 90s. Are really going into the history of slavery, taking a deep dive through the writing of fiction to imagine what it's very hard to capture if you're a historian, because the kind of way to ground those claims is sometimes difficult to locate in available archives, to use the work of creative imagination to fill in that experience. And those women too, those creative writers, are creating and contributing to what I call a Black feminist philosophy of history. And that term, philosophy of history, is one that I'm borrowing and then retooling out of the work of Walter Benjamin.
I think in conceptualizing this moment when, as a field, African-American women's history came to be, there were substantial methodological changes underway in which there was less of a qualitative focus on the study of slavery, and in particular, the use of qualitative analysis by scholars like Robert Fogel and Stanley Ingerman to, argue against the notion that slave breeding was practiced in any substantial way in the antebellum South, thinking also of John Bull's work in Black Southerners. But it was the use of WPA narratives by scholars like Deborah Gray White and Jacqueline Jones and other historians who have come after them, including Jennifer Morgan and Sasha Turner, who we mentioned earlier, who were able to really demonstrate that forced breeding was essential to this slave economy, particularly in the post-1807 moment. I'm also thinking of Gregory Smithers' new book, Slave Breeding. And so it's interesting for me as a historian to hear the names of individuals who I've had the great privilege of working with, but also those whose scholarship continues to guide the questions and the types of research and the methodologies that we employ in our scholarship, to be thought of and to be credited as theorists in their own right. I think it's a very important intervention that you're making.
Mm-hmm. I love the way you've put that. And I think it's, understanding Black feminist work across its idioms of expression as part of a large collective project to which Black feminist historians made a huge contribution. And all of these things are in a kind of synergy with each other as forms of cultural expression in this period. And I think because you are a historian, you're hearing the impact of this argument for what it means to reclaim the contributions made by women that were studying the history of enslaved women in the 70s, 80s, and 90s as theorists, right, who ought to be understood as making a contribution to the Black radical tradition, but haven't been. But that I would say that they are a part of a much larger groundswell of interest in this question. That because all of these people were reading each other's work and understanding each other's work, and in some ways working across idioms, even if they didn't talk about those different disciplines or idioms in their own writing, it was all mutually informing and creating this this new way of thinking that we now have inherited.
And to kind of return to this notion of the kind of the interdisciplinary dialogue and conversations that were being had among Black feminist scholars during this time, I think that your book also demonstrates that women beyond history, thinking of Hazel Carby, Sadia Hartman, and other literary scholars who invoke or utilize a Black feminist framework in their scholarship and thinking about the writings of Black women, fictional writings, but also autobiographical writings as well, to expand the notion of slavery's archive, to also encompass works of fiction, film, and other literary mediums. And so in chapter 3 of The Afterlives of Reproductive Slavery, you foreground the use of what you call critical speculative engagement as a tool to constellate the enslaved past and the biocapitalist present. And so, as mentioned just a few moments ago, as a historian, there are so many scholars of enslaved women like Nell Painter and Darlene Clark Kine, Marisa Fuentes, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, and others who have had to rely on this tool, this as a methodological insight into the worlds of women who are so archivally illegible. And so, put simply, there really are some things we may never know about enslaved women's lives, but by utilizing this very interdisciplinary approach to their scholarship and the questions that they're asking, you're able to demonstrate that critical speculative engagement is necessary for retooling or reconstructing, rather, the lives of enslaved women in the past. And so in chapter 3, I really enjoyed your close reading of Toni Morrison's classic novel, Beloved. And while many literary critics and scholars have convincingly suggested that the novel's protagonist, Seethe, was inspired by Margaret Garner, a woman who murdered her child to avoid a lifetime of enslavement in 1856, you speculate that the inspiration for Seethe's character was inspired by the experiences of another more contemporary insurgent African-American woman. And so I'm hoping you could discuss who she was and if you could tell us more about her story.
Sure. So it's Joan Little. And you know, this is a woman that was at the center of debates about women's right to self-defense in the context of assault and violence. And she was a Black woman who was thought to be the murderer of her jailer, who attempted to rape her when she was imprisoned. And she, you know, became a sort of cause celeb who many people rallied around to suggest that when women, especially women of color, were sexually assaulted, they had the right to self-defense. And so I make a connection between Joan Little and Margaret Garner, but also the character of Seethe in Morrison's Beloved, because I became aware through a really wonderful story of the connection in Morrison's mind between what she was learning about the Joan Little case and what she was doing while she was writing Beloved. And she actually places into the hand of Seethe when she makes her insurgent attack against the white man who she mistakes as the slave catcher. She attacks him with an ice pick. And of course, this was the weapon of choice, the only weapon available to Joan Little in prison when she attacked her jailer. So, you know, I'm trying to create those bridges or those constellations, to borrow Benjamin's term, of past and present, not just in the way in which the novel has most often been interpreted, which is as a rewriting of Margaret Garner case, an actual historical case of a slave woman committing infanticide in order to free her child from recapture and enslavement. But I'm trying to connect it to the contemporary world in which Morrison was writing, in which Black women were protesting their sexual and reproductive exploitation. So, it's a great story. I didn't really know how to think about that ice pick. And I was listening to a talk by a colleague and friend of mine, Emily Thuma, talking about the Joan Little case, and she flashed on the screen a photograph of a t-shirt that she had found in an archival box saying power to the ice pick, which was a t-shirt worn by a protester at one of the Free Joan Little marches. Joan Little went by many names, and even the spelling of her name is different. So if I'm slipping among them, it's Joan, Joanne, depending what you're reading. And so I learned about this use of the ice pick in that case, and it sparked the connection to the Beloved novel and led to my reinterpretation of that final scene in the novel in this direction.
So rounding out our really rich conversation, conversation about your book. In later chapters of the book, you heed Sadia Hartman's observation that to tell the lies of enslaved women often requires inserting oneself at the intersection of fiction and the historical, the fictive and the historical, rather, excuse me. And so your analysis that you alluded to previously in thinking of the dystopian novels of Octavia Butler, speculative fiction, film, and other creative mediums really brought to life, for me, the interpretive genius of your work and made many of the connections you set out in the introduction of your book about Black feminism's philosophy of history and its multiple idioms concretized in my mind. And so to close out our conversation, I was hoping that you could mention perhaps your analysis of Butler's work and the other novels and films that you discuss in later chapters of the book and the ways in which they helped inform your arguments about the constellation of the enslaved past and the biocapitalist present.
It's a big question because the book is really divided into two parts. And the first part of the book is about what we've been talking about, which is the ways in which Black feminism produces a philosophy of history that connects the enslaved past to the biocapitalist present around the figure of the reproductive body and its racialized exploitation, and the way in which that's thought about in fiction and by historians and others and legal scholars. And in the second half of the book, I'm turning more to the question of neoliberalism and the ways in which one of the things that I believe characterizes the neoliberal period, the neoliberal moment, is the erasure or the disavow of the relevance of the history of slavery to the present moment in which we're living. And so I use fictions that are produced in the context of neoliberalism and read them as meditations on this process of erasure. And I think that the work of Octavia Butler across really her entire corpus is just a beautiful example of how slavery is animated as a sort of guiding episteme for understanding human exploitation. And at the same time, it never appears in the guises that are most familiar to us as, the slavery of Black people in the context of Atlantic slavery. It does do that in her one novel, Kindred, but even there, it's a complex time travel novel in which there's a shuttling between the past and the present that takes place. But in other stories by her and in other writings by her, the enslaved past emerges as often as a question of interspecies exploitation, of the reproductive capacities of one species by another species. And even in some of the interviews with Butler herself, she would deny the connection to slavery. And so I basically am making an argument for reading some of this speculative fiction as speaking to the disavow of slavery in the context of neoliberalism, the disavow of racism as animating contemporary capitalism. And sort of looking at the ways in which texts, especially literary texts written in this moment, really allow us a window onto this process of the erasure of slavery. Because it's not to say that Octavia Butler didn't think slavery was absolutely key. I think she understood that totally and completely. But she wrote novels that allowed us to explore the ways in which human exploitation is always in some ways grounded in and through the history of slavery, even when that is the denied context for that exploitation. So it's a second part of the argument that's quite complicated. And in some ways, it's an argument about the evisceration of what Robin Kelly, the historian, would call the freedom dreams of Black feminism. And it's about how hard it is to recuperate the insurgency of enslaved women, both because of the problems of the archive, but also because of the political moment in which that project of recuperation might be enacted. And so I view speculative fiction as a sort of window onto the processes by which slavery is treated in contemporary biocapitalism and racial capitalism.
If I may ask you one final question, what is the largest takeaway you hope that readers of your book and listeners of our podcast will have after reading your book?
I just get one. I don't know. I think it's that slavery endures as an animating, idea in contemporary capitalism, and that unless we come to terms with this, we will not really be able to understand the racialized and gendered exploitation that makes contemporary capitalism go. And while surrogacy isn't a widespread practice, although it's an increasingly widespread practice, it functions as a lens or a heuristic device that allows us to understand the ways in which gendered, sexualized, and racialized forms of exploitation that have their roots, their epistemic roots in slavery, continue to animate the operations of capitalism today. And so it's that thinking back and forth across time, which necessitates constellating the past with the present in the interest of the future. And then it's, that idea that we have to think historically if we want to understand our present moment.
I wanted to thank you, Professor Weinbaum, for taking the time to be on the show today. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
It's been really fun, and what an astute reader of the book you are. I really appreciated your summaries of some of the arguments.
Thank you so much.